A May Day like few others in recent memory as the Lone Star State begins a slow reopen. Texans get back to work or perhaps not. The story today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. With support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. May 1st, due day for millions of renters, Dallas and Austin among cities offering relief. Why Texas's biggest city hasn't joined them. The Texas Attorney General weighs in on property rights in Colorado. What's up with that? Also, the week in Texas politics with the Texas Tribune, the typewriter rodeo, and a whole lot more. It's the Friday edition of the national news show of You Know Where, and it all gets started right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this first day of May 2020. I'm David Brown. Here we are 6 weeks into a crisis that few of us could have imagined the dimensions of just 2 months ago. Indeed, most of us likely still don't have a great handle on what the ultimate impact of this moment will be. On the one hand, for example, the markets appear unusually resilient, but on this May Day, millions are out of work, and predictions of a hard impact compared to that of the Great Depression are easy to come by. Today could be, and we should underscore, could be, the beginning of the end of massive layoffs and the like. At least that's what many in Texas are hoping for, as Texas Governor Greg Abbott and other governors across the nation have decided to relax stay-at-home orders and restrictions on some businesses to get people back to work. Or it could be the beginning of a major rebound in coronavirus cases after signs of improvement. Since the very beginning of this crisis, officials say they've had to play a grim balancing act between doing what's best for health and safety and running the risk of cratering an economy which puts food on the table. Now begins a test of whether the steps Texas is taking are the right ones, whether the Lone Star State can get back to work, whether it's too early, and whether these moves that begin today ultimately help or harm the welfare of everyone as we move deeper into uncharted territory. On this Friday, we begin by turning to what reporters across the state are learning about this gradual phased-in reopening in real time. Joining us is Nick Garcia, who covers Dallas County politics and government for the Dallas Morning News. Nick, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Also on the line with us from out El Paso way, it's Angela Kocherka. She's news director for member station KTEP in El Paso. Angela, welcome.
Hi, David.
And John Wayne Ferguson, senior reporter for the Galveston County Daily News. John, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, John, let's begin with you. Galveston being a popular tourist spot, summer getting close. How are city leaders and businesses responding there to phase one of Governor Abbott's reopening?
Well, you know, the beaches are opening today on Galveston Island. That came after the Texas General Land Office said that local decisions about opening beaches were up to the state, not to the cities at this point. So the beaches are here, and we're preparing for a lot of people to come down. The city has, some city leaders have expressed some frustration at that. The beaches have been closed, at least in the city limits, since March 29th for the most part. And there was talk about keeping some limits there, maybe into this weekend. With that not being able to happen, I think some city leaders are now just telling people that live on the island to be careful, maybe do your shopping in grocery stores and other places now.
How many people actually live on the island versus the tourist population? Is there? Could you give us a sense of that?
I mean, 50,000 people live on the island. On the busiest of weekends, we can have up to 500,000 people here on Memorial Day and 4th of July and things like that.
I see. I bet there's a lot of pent-up demand as well. Nick, I want to loop you in. Dallas County Judge Clay Jenkins earlier this week said that the county had not met certain benchmarks in keeping COVID-19 cases down, and that's been a real concern statewide. How's the county trying to gauge these benchmarks here, and what are you hearing about reopening there?
Sure. So I think we can't not start this conversation without noting that yesterday we, Dallas County, reported the highest number of new COVID cases since they started releasing this data, 179 new cases,
wow.
Five more deaths. We crossed, you know, one, bringing our total to 104, that very, very, very grim milestone. You know, Judge Clay Jenkins is concerned. We have not seen, you know, the number of new cases go down. We have not seen a steady decline in deaths. While last week we thought there might be some hope because our numbers were lower than the week before, this week their numbers are dramatically back up. And that is giving, you know, Judge Jenkins real, real pause. I think what's really fascinating, you know, I was reading some additional reporting from around the state this morning. It looks like Governor Abbott's looking at different data sets. The mayor of Dallas is looking at different data sets. Judge Jenkins is looking at different data sets. And so it's really confusing for us reporters, for the, you know, the general public to make sense when we can't even agree on what data set is most important. And I think we're going to see, you know, a real tussle among elected officials over what data really matters here.
That is fascinating. Not everyone is on the same page, to be sure. But there does seem to be a lot of pent-up demand for shopping in restaurants, unless I'm mistaken, just judging from some of the reporting I've been reading in the Dallas Morning News.
You know, there's obviously pent-up frustration. Everyone wants to get out. Everyone wants to, you know, go and be with their friends. And yet, you know, most national polls, most local polls will show that people are still willing to stay inside if it means keeping them safe. And Judge Jenkins has repeated, you know, we saw earlier in this conversation, we saw Judge Jenkins really try to lobby Governor Abbott directly to, you know, follow the science and to move slow and steady. And, you know, since Governor Abbott has, you know, made his decision, you've seen Jenkins direct his lobbying to the local audience. You know, this week he told people, it's now up to you to keep you safe. It's now up to you to make sure you're wearing masks in public, that you're social distancing, that you are keeping, you know, your loved ones protected. And I thought that was a real interesting shift in tone. And one other data point that I thought was really fascinating that the county just started releasing this week, I think in sort of a rebuttal to Governor Abbott's decision, almost 80% of the people of COVID cases and who have given the county their occupation are frontline workers. People in the travel industry, people in healthcare, people at grocery stores. So we are seeing these people who have been out amongst the public during these last, you know, 6 weeks the most, report making up a large share of cases.
John, what's the situation looking like in terms of the number of cases, number of diagnoses of coronavirus in Galveston?
Well, there's 45 cases on Galveston Island, according to the Galveston County Health District. There's 595 cases diagnosed in Galveston County, which, of course, is a lot of those mainland communities before you get to the Galveston Causeway. A lot of our cases are connected to nursing homes. 160 or so of those 595 are directly connected to some nursing home outbreaks. So there isn't there is not a lot of cases on Galveston Island, but I think there's this idea that, again, looking at how many people are coming from other places and Harris County in particular, there's an awareness that the local numbers maybe don't show the whole scale of the area numbers.
Now, I do want to turn to Angela Kucherga, who is in El Paso, where there have been a lot of layoffs there, as there have been across the Lone Star State. Angela, what are you hearing from local officials there, and how does what your experience square with what you're hearing from Dallas and Galveston?
Well, David, there's a lot of concern on the part of El Paso County and city leaders, as well as public health authorities. Of course, everyone would like the economy to open up. Livelihoods are at stake, but so are lives. And we're seeing cases rapidly rise here. We definitely have not reached the peak. So El Paso had a stay-home, work-safe order that was not set to expire until May 17th. But of course, the governor's orders to reopen the economy supersedes all of that on a local level. And that sends a mixed message. This is how El Paso County Judge Ricardo Samaniego put it.
My message of containment, my message of supporting public health has now faded completely. It's not that strong anymore because, of, you know, Dad said you could go out and play and Mom said no.
Ultimately, though, is it the decision in the hands of business owners and individuals whether or not they're going to make the choices they believe to be the best for them?
It is, and some business, especially really small ones, won't be able to comply with that social distancing. But at the same time, the concern is that people will think, okay, we're open now, we're open for business, and large gatherings will begin in El Paso, and Mother's Day's around the corner, and that's a huge holiday here on both sides of the border. The other thing, you know, to show how concerned people are in this region, Fort Bliss is continuing to keep in place its stay-home orders. And the Post yesterday reminded soldiers, do not leave. You cannot leave to go shopping or go to restaurants in El Paso. And just across the state line in New Mexico, the mayor of Las Cruces also told residents, please don't go to El Paso right now. Cases are on the rise in this region.
Obviously, there's a whole lot of information to explore further, but we're out of time. So hopefully we can loop back and check in once again next week to find out how folks are faring. Angela Kucherga is news director for member station KTEP in El Paso. We've also heard the voice of Nick Garcia, who covers Dallas County politics and government. And John Wayne Ferguson is covering things as senior reporter for the Galveston County Daily News. Thanks to you all for taking a few minutes out of your schedules to speak with us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, David.
Wells Dunbar is monitoring what Texans are talking about on social media. Hello there, Wells.
Hi, David. Yeah, we're hearing from folks about the reopening of Texas businesses, from potential shoppers and diners and business owners alike. Here's what some of the latter have to say. Dan Leitner writes that Texas is only at 1% testing and almost no contact tracing. There's been a spike of cases in DFW, where I live. My retail business will remain closed until I can better guarantee the safety of my customers and myself. Meanwhile, Anthony Dallas Grossclose writes, we have to open up soon. Small businesses like mine are on the verge of bankruptcy. And this comment from Genevieve Coons-Herendon. She works in the service industry, and she writes, besides there being no consistent downward slope of new cases or deaths, no increased testing, and no way to contact trace, the governor gave these businesses 4 days to figure out how to keep their employees and guests safe. Hearing from dozens and dozens more people about the ramifications of these openings, whether or not they'll be venturing out this weekend as those restrictions are relaxed. I'll be back with those reactions and a lot more later in the show, David.
You know, I've been hearing from some small business owners who say that the economics of the situation just don't add up for them. If they're going to go 25% reopen, it just the numbers just don't work. We'd love to hear from you if you are a small business owner on this Friday. How are you factoring in all of the many moving parts here? How are you making your decision? Tweet us at Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar is looking for you. He'll be back in 35.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas ABLE program, a tax advantage savings program helping eligible Texans with disabilities save for the future. Learn more, including how the program works with certain public benefits, at texasable.org.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. For millions of Texans, it's rent day, but a substantial number of renters have been without work for weeks and may not be able to pay. An order from the state Supreme Court has temporarily halted evictions, and some cities, including Austin and Dallas, have rushed in to help, too. The biggest city in Texas, however, has not followed their lead. Houston Public Media's Jen Rice reports.
For weeks, housing advocates have been asking for help for renters at Houston City Council. Zoe Middleton with Texas Housers warned officials, renters need more than just donations, and time is running out.
The Houston Apartment Association's $100K rental assistance fund is effectively meaningless compared to the depth of the crisis that we face. It is charity and not policy, so I'm here today to ask you for policy.
City Council members have asked Mayor Sylvester Turner to intervene too. First, they point to other Texas cities that have already put money in people's hands to help pay rent. Houston hasn't announced any details to distribute $400 million in emergency federal aid that's sitting in the bank. Middleton is hoping it all goes to rent relief.
I ask that the city spend the entirety of its allocation on rental assistance, providing financial support directly to renters and small holding landlords.
But some elected officials argue the city can't help families with their rent unless they help businesses with their rent, too. Here's District G Councilmember Greg Travis.
And if we do this, I don't know if it'd be unfair to leave others out. There's the commercial aspect. There are people who can't pay their employees and pay their rent for their businesses.
Austin, Dallas, and San Antonio, however, have all set aside millions in direct assistance for renters. They expect most of it will be reimbursed with federal funding. What's more, Houston is also falling behind other cities in protecting renters from eviction. The state Supreme Court has banned them until May 18th, but in Austin and Dallas, renters have an extra grace period. That means Dallas renters are protected until mid-June, but Houston renters can be evicted in less than 3 weeks from now. At a Houston council meeting, At-Large 5 Councilmember Letitia Plummer said she asked the mayor's office to create a similar grace period.
And I know that Austin has done some things to support our tenants. And after talking to the city attorney, that was not something that we were able to do from a legal perspective.
I asked the city to explain why Austin's ordinance wouldn't be legal in Houston, and they declined to answer the question. But legal experts disagree.
There shouldn't be anything that prevents the city of Houston from doing that. If Dallas and Austin are able to do that, then Houston should be able to as well.
That's University of Texas law professor Heather Way. She's tracking these policies across the state. Way says Houston ranks at the bottom of Texas cities helping renters during the COVID crisis.
Yeah, I mean, my understanding is that Houston really hasn't done much of anything in terms of enhancing protections for renters on the eviction front and has done very little, if anything, in terms of funding support and assistance to help tenants get through this.
In Dallas, Sandy Rollins with the Texas Tenants Union helped push for the extra grace period there. She disagrees with Houston City Attorney and says Houston could pass a similar ordinance.
You know, there's a huge tenant population there, and it seems negligent for Houston not to step up and recognize what lies ahead for tenants when the courts reopen.
Mayor Turner has said his recovery czar will have a plan soon on how to distribute the city's federal aid. I'm Jen Rice in Houston.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, providing community relief actions for the COVID-19 crisis, including early dividend distribution to eligible policyholders. More at texasmutual.com/dividends.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. As we continue to explore the real-world rollout of Governor Abbott's new orders on this May 1st, KERA's Saida Hassan wanted to find out how restaurants in North Texas are dealing with the decision of whether to try a limited reopening or not.
At Bangkok City Restaurant on Bryan Street, owner Jan Penn Taiwan Kao Kennedy and her husband Philip Kennedy are rearranging the dining room to seat a maximum of 16 customers. That's as many people as they can accommodate under new guidelines from the state. The Thai restaurant in East Dallas has built a loyal customer base after more than 20 years in business.
Yeah, they keep us going and call and see how we're doing and try to help.
Under an executive order from Texas Governor Greg Abbott, restaurants in Dallas County can resume dine-in service with some restrictions. They can't exceed 25% capacity. Tables can seat up to 6 people, and parties have to stay at least 6 feet apart. In counties with very few COVID-19 cases, capacity can be higher. Philip Kennedy says to-go orders have been popular since North Texas adopted shelter-in-place orders, but they only account for about 20% of regular business. Bangkok City has been able to retain its entire staff, though hours have been cut. Kennedy says resuming dine-in service is crucial to sustaining business.
It's great that we're going to have the opportunity to have it just be 16. So I think that's a very positive sign, and we're optimistic.
For others, reopening at 25% capacity just doesn't make fiscal sense. Spencer Fox is the director of coffee at Fiction Coffee on North Hall Street.
You know, no matter how much we love our customers, you know, you can only spend so much money on a cup of coffee. And if you sit there for a couple hours and limit that, you know, it's not very financially feasible for us.
Fox says they've had to make tough decisions since the COVID-19 outbreak began, reducing pay across the board and giving staff the option to go on furlough. 4 baristas have taken him up on that. Fox knows some employees don't feel safe coming to work right now, potentially being in close contact with customers. In Dallas County, community transmission continues to be the leading risk factor for COVID-19, meaning most people who have tested positive don't know how they got the illness. Fox says he's staying in touch with furloughed workers.
They've been giving us love and we've been giving them love back, you know, just waiting for the time for that they'll want to be able to come back to work.
For now, his team has turned the tiny Fiction Coffee parking lot into a makeshift drive-through. Customers can call ahead before picking up their orders. Fox says they plan to continue using this system, keeping the dine-in area closed until further notice.
A lot of our regulars that are coming in every day are a lot of the healthcare workers at Baylor Dallas right here next to us. You know, they're telling us to be safer than anything. And at 50%, we can't do it. And even at 75%, we probably aren't going to do it.
The first phase of the governor's plan also allows retail stores, movie theaters, malls, libraries, and museums to reopen with limited capacity. If Texas does not see a spike in COVID-19 cases over the next 2 weeks, restrictions could be loosened even further, as early as May 18th. That's when Governor Abbott would consider opening bars, gyms, salons, and barbershops, though it all depends on whether there are flare-ups of COVID-19. I'm Saida Hassan in Dallas.
Well, now HEB says it's going to begin putting purchasing limits in place for meat items in some parts of Texas just days after announcing it'd be lifting limits on certain household goods. The Texas-based supermarket chain said it'll be limiting how much meat shoppers can buy. Limits vary by region. This comes as supply chains are expected to tighten due to coronavirus outbreaks at meat processing plants across the U.S. The United Food and Commercial Workers International Union says more than 20 meat plant workers have already died from COVID-19, and many facilities have shut down to try to contain the spread. Several facilities in Texas have experienced COVID outbreaks among their workers, including JBS Beef in the Panhandle and a Tyson plant in East Texas. The impact goes way beyond HEB, of course, and many expect inflationary pressure on food prices more broadly. This is a developing story we'll be tracking here at The Standard. Texas News Roundup is just around the corner. It's 29 minutes past the hour.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Texas oil giant ExxonMobil is not expecting the global economy to recover quickly. In an earnings conference call today, CEO Darren Woods says low demand for fossil fuels is projected to continue through the summer and fall.
As we reach the fourth quarter, we expect demand will be below last year due to lost economic activity. Of course, there's a lot of uncertainty on the timing of the recovery. We're planning for a slow one, as it takes time to restart businesses and for consumers' confidence to grow.
The Irving-based company today posted a $610 million loss for the first quarter. Exxon plans to reduce operations at most of its oil rigs in the Permian Basin by the end of 2020 to reduce cost. A number of Texas colleges and universities are announcing plans to reopen their campuses in the fall. Among them is Southern Methodist University in Dallas. The school is developing protocols to prevent the spread of the coronavirus, such as restricting the number of students in a classroom at any given time. SMU President Gerald Turner says many students are eager to return to campus after taking classes remotely.
Students don't feel like they're really around students just on Zoom. And a huge part of what makes up a college education, if you ask students that are graduating, what are the 10 things that meant the most to you in terms of your collegiate education, one of them at the close to the top, if not the top, is always what I've learned from other students, both in classroom and out of classroom, just the whole living learning experience.
Other universities planning to reopen this fall include Baylor, Texas Tech, and the Texas A&M University System. The Texas Education Agency is working on guidelines for graduations that it plans to share with public schools in the next 2 weeks. In the meantime, a few districts in North Texas have already decided to hold commencement ceremonies virtually. That includes Dallas and Fort Worth ISDs. Clint Bond is the spokesperson for Fort Worth ISD.
And we really want the seniors to understand that we are celebrating their hard-earned success. And even though they can't do it in person with their peers and their parents and their teachers, we believe that this is the best way, the right way to go for everyone concerned.
Several smaller school districts in North Texas are planning in-person graduations amid the ongoing pandemic. Lewisville ISD will hold ceremonies at the Texas Motor Speedway. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the law firm of Barron, Adler, Clough, and Odo, handling eminent domain and condemnation cases throughout Texas, protecting private property rights for over 30 years. BarronAdler.com.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. The Texas Attorney General is known for issuing opinions in legal cases, sometimes just legal situations, not necessarily court filings or anything along those lines. But recently, Ken Paxton weighed in on a matter that raised a few eyebrows, seeing that he's the Attorney General of Texas and not of Colorado. Gunnison County, Colorado, is home to some of the best skiing in the world, and it appears that the Texas Attorney General is aware of this fact because he recently issued a statement concerning what happens to many of those who own property there in Gunnison County, Colorado. Here to explain what's going on is Paul Weber, an Austin-based reporter for the Associated Press. Paul, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
As I understand it, the Attorney General has written a letter to who exactly, and what is it that he is asking for Colorado officials to do?
Yeah, so what happened was General Paxton issued a letter on April 9th to Gunnison County, Colorado. The quick backstory there is that Gunnison County issued some pretty restrictive orders around the time that states and cities nationwide were imposing stricter social distancing requirements, closing schools, stay-at-home orders. Gunnison went further than most. They ordered everyone who wasn't a permanent resident there to leave. And they said they needed to do this in order to clear out the town as much as possible so as not to overwhelm what few medical resources they have.
Okay, let me stop you right there. So what Gunnison County is doing is they're saying tourists go home, right? We're gonna lock this down, and we're going to preserve our resources for those who live here full time.
Exactly.
And so the Attorney General of Texas weighs in. Why exactly?
Well, that's what we were curious about, too. So his argument in his letter was that what the county was doing was unconstitutional. He said that the county cannot banish Texans who own property there. It's their property, he said. They have a right to it.
I see.
My colleague and I, Jake Blyberg, when we started looking into it, though, as to who exactly owns property in Gunnison County from Texas, we quickly found out it's a pretty exclusive group of people.
Are there a lot of Texans who live in Gunnison County?
Not really. There's fewer than 2,000, according to Gunnison County property records.
That still sounds like a sizable number, but maybe one of those 2,000 reached out to the Attorney General. Is that how what you found, or what did you find?
Yeah, so when we got a list of, you know, who owned property there, if you look at that list, some names jump out. Houston home builder Richard Weekly, who's been a prominent campaign contributor for decades here in Texas. Kyle Stallings, he's a Midland oil man who has especially given a lot of money to General Paxton and his wife. So we started to see donors appear on this list, including those to General Paxton.
So are you saying that basically his campaign donors alerted him to what was happening in Gunnison County and wanted the AG to support them as they tried to enjoy their property in Colorado?
Well, here's what we know. So there was one name on the list. As we were reporting, one name kept coming up, and his name is Robert McCarter. What we found out getting records from Colorado County was that in the days before General Paxton sent this letter, Robert McCarter had twice asked Gunnison County for permission to remain. He wanted an exemption to stay in his home while everyone else was leaving, and he'd basically been unsuccessful up to that point. What we found was that Robert McCarter was a classmate of General Paxton at Baylor University in the 80s, and that his only campaign contribution, according to Texas campaign finance records, was $5,000 on the day that General Paxton launched his run for Attorney General in 2013. So what we know is that the timing was that, you know, Mr. McCarter was seeking an exemption to stay, had not gone to that point, and then the Attorney General sends a letter on April 9th, 3 hours after General Paxton announces that he's sending this letter to Colorado. Gunnison County approves Mr. McCarter's request to stay.
But other than the timing of Gunnison County officials taking action, is there anything else to suggest that the Attorney General's letter had impact?
Not at this moment. Mr. McCarter did not return multiple calls and emails we had left for him. General Paxton's office did not address questions about Mr. McCarter. So we don't know, you know, whether, in fact, they did have a conversation prior to this. Gunnison County said the timing was coincidental and that they were not aware that they had any relationship.
Interesting. Has the Attorney General had anything to say about your investigative work?
When we reached out to the Attorney General's office, they said that, you know, the Attorney General speaks on behalf of Texans, but they would not address questions over, you know, whether, for instance, the Attorney General spoke to Mr. McCarter prior to getting involved, whether he spoke to other donors before getting involved. They said they could not identify specific homeowners that they may have, you know, had conversations with, but that was about the extent of what they told us.
Paul Weber is an Austin-based reporter for the Associated Press. Paul, thanks for telling us the story.
Thank you so much.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, dedicated to improving healthcare in North Texas and around the world through pursuits like the new TCU and UNTHSC School of Medicine, educating empathetic scholars. TCU, lead on.
I'm Jillian Robb, and I live in the Highland neighborhood in Austin, Texas. My grandparents pretty much raised me off and on. I'm their only grandchild. And my beautiful grandfather, who has been just, you know, a rock, he fell, and it turned out that it was a stroke. And, you know, I can't get to him right now, which has been difficult. I decided just to write him a letter, just one letter that told him in clear, plain speech what he meant to me, what it meant when he rescued me when I was 16 in the middle of the night in his car, what it meant when he let me move in with them when I was 17, you know, what his guidance has meant to my life. And the fact that when he dies, I will have to reframe the way that I view this world. So I wrote it down, put a stamp on it, and put it in my mailbox.
I've become a lot more observational about my neighborhood. I haven't really met neighbors, per se. That day I was walking along and saw what looked like a, you know, like a birthday card or a thank you note or something that looked a little more important than just junk mail thrown on the ground. So I just looked for the address, didn't want to put it back in the mailbox, of course, so I put it on the porch and wrote a little note on it.
We may have been out in our driveway, but we went back in the house, and I just came back out a couple hours later, and there it was, and it had been ripped open, the envelope had ripped open, and somebody had written, "I found this about a block away," with a little frowny face on it, and it was stuck under the aloe plant on our front porch. And I came in and showed it to my husband, and my immediate reaction was one of anger, like somebody took this letter. And I immediately thought, that's not what I'm going to focus on here. I'm going to focus on the fact that some human being that lives in my neighborhood found this letter and walked it down to me and wrote a note on the front of it and got it back to me. And his name was David.
Yeah, I'm David Sheldon, and I live in the Highland area of Austin. I just, like, I would want to know. I definitely used the word stoked, I think. I said something along the line of, sometimes if you are depressed, it is so nice to feel like the good guy. And thanked her for letting me know. Anyway.
Oh, this is, I mean, it's so stressful and it's so scary, but it's also a real opportunity to be there for our neighbors and to be really available and That's the thing that we've noticed, you know, running around the neighborhoods and walking around the neighborhoods is people are waving out of their car windows at you. There's a kind of emotional availability amongst neighbors that we haven't noticed before this. And it's scary and it's hard. But I think, you know, anything hard presents an opportunity for something good to come out of it, you know, and I do think that that's what we're seeing, you know, on a small scale, at least in our neighborhood, at least in the Highland neighborhood. Hi, my name is Jillian Robb. I live in the Highland neighborhood in Austin, Texas.
This is David Shelton from Austin, and you're listening to the Texas Standard.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard.
It's Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. One big question so far still largely unanswered is how many large corporations ended up getting money that was supposed to be earmarked for small business. Who approved these loans? Now comes round two of the Paycheck Protection Program, and as banks process requests from small business to tap into a $700 billion fund aimed at saving those small businesses and keeping workers employed, Latino business owners say they've spotted a pattern, and they don't like what they see. Texas Public Radio's Paul Flav has more.
Claudia Garza and her husband Rick own Bright and Early Productions, a photography and videography company targeting the real estate industry.
Today we're at a beautiful new listing with my man Jesse Lopez with JP and Associates.
That's Rick Garza setting up for a shoot in one of their promotional videos. The business has taken an economic hit because they're only producing for homes that are unoccupied now. They've had to reduce their employees' hours as a result. When they found out that $349 billion was set aside for the first round of the Paycheck Protection Program, they wanted to apply through the bank where they have their business and personal accounts, Wells Fargo. But they couldn't.
It feels like I'm a small fish compared to, I don't know, the people who have larger accounts or maybe contacts within the bank. You know, I don't have a contact at Wells Fargo. I never have.
Garza describes first having trouble getting people on the phone, and then when she did, how slow their pace was. She ended up moving her application to the Lyft Fund, a community development financial institution. While much quicker, the Small Business Administration ran out of money before they were approved. Many small organizations are in the same position, and early data from Latino advocacy organizations are showing Latinos are being left behind.
The data shows that Latinos and Latinas have not received their fair share of the program, the protection money, the PPP.
Ramiro Cavazos is CEO of the U.S. Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. Alongside the League of United Latin American Citizens, they presented data showing 70% of the Latino-owned businesses that completed their application and were surveyed have not received any funding. That's data from a LULAC questionnaire filled out by about 800 businesses. CEO Cindy Benavides says several reports show Latino and minority-owned businesses are running out of time.
Many of them have fewer than 21 days of cash. What does that mean for our community? That means that at least 50% of Latino businesses will be out of business before we see any direct impact by the federal government.
And some of the nation's largest lenders offered few and at times no loans to Latino business owners. According to their data, JP Morgan Chase and Bank of America accepted only 12% of the nearly 80 Latino applicants surveyed. Wells Fargo, one of the biggest lenders in the nation and one of the bank's Latino business owners replied to the most, funded zero PPP Latino applicants surveyed. In a response, the company said they were hiring more people to process the next round and happy it got replenished. Janie Gonzalez, CEO of Webhead Technology, a San Antonio IT company, wasn't surprised by these early data points.
So this is not new. This pandemic and how banks treat minorities isn't new.
Gonzalez said accessing credit was incredibly hard when she got started, and loans were charging in excess of 28%. She was grateful for that.
You know, if anything I've seen amplified is that there's classism. It's always existed.
Gonzalez was approved for the first round of PPP. She says that's because she went with a regional bank, not Bank of America, where she also has an account. Advocates are asking for $50 billion to be set aside for Hispanic or Latino businesses. Latino businesses are often smaller and have a less established relationship with a bank, and they're more likely to face challenges being accepted for a business loan. Again, the Hispanic Chamber's Ramiro Cavazos.
One out of every two of our businesses are micro businesses. We don't need to lose those businesses, because if we do, we'll lose them permanently.
They also want the Small Business Administration to release data that would give a more complete picture of who got funded. I'm Paul Flav in San Antonio.
Well, as this Friday got underway, there were reports that workers at several companies, including Texas-based Whole Foods, were staging a general strike calling for safer working conditions. Workers at Amazon warehouses, Amazon-owned Whole Foods, as well as gig workers for delivery services Instacart and Shipt, walking off the job today for International Workers' Day, May 1st. We'll keep you posted as this story develops, coming up on 49 Minutes Past the Hour.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
I'm Carrie Ann Holt, and I write poems on the spot with Typewriter Radio. Homeschooling. This poem is for every kid drowned by all the bubbles on all the tests. For the kids who work fast and wait. For the ones who work better on the move, spinning circles around those inexplicable stationary desks. This poem is for everyone who learns by experience, by dirt and sweat, who needs a moment of quiet away from the rest. This is for everyone who knows deep in their heart that homeschooling, distance learning, whatever you call it, is just as important, maybe more, as taking a breath, sleeping past nine, and digging a big hole in the yard. I'm Carrie Ann Holt with Typewriter Rodeo, and you are listening to Texas Standard.
Support for Typewriter Rodeo comes from Texas Children's Hospital, here to help Texas families navigate this crisis with regular updates, resources, and advice. More at texaschildrenscoronavirus.org.
We're always collecting requests for the Typewriter Rodeo team. Send us your ideas for a poem via social media or just email us, texasstandard@kut.org. Then make sure to tune in Fridays here on The Standard or anytime with the Typewriter Rodeo podcast. We can't let a Friday go by without checking in with our friends over at the Texas Tribune. Joining us now, Matthew Watkins, political editor for the Trib. Matthew, thanks for taking a few minutes out to talk with us as we look back on the week that was. Okay, so we were talking earlier in the broadcast with reporters around the state about this phase one starting today, opening up Texas. Y'all have been in touch with local officials, business owners. What have you been hearing there at the Trib?
Yeah, you know, surprisingly, we thought that maybe the biggest pushback would come from the big city kind of Democratic officials. You know, Abbott's order supersedes some of the rules that they put in place. But really, the most kind of outright defiance has come from more suburban Republican-leaning areas, you know, particularly from kind of the hard right. You saw Montgomery County, Colleyville, Hood County local officials basically testing Abbott's order, saying they would open up hair salons, places that remain closed from now. Others kind of, you know, suggesting they wouldn't enforce the restrictions as strictly as maybe Abbott would have liked.
I'm surprised to hear you say that, because as we were talking with other reporters around the state, it seemed like local officials were very frustrated with Governor Abbott's move, saying it was too early. From the sound of what you're saying, it's suburban officials saying this isn't enough.
Sure. And I think there is a bit of a sense from the big city local officials that it is too early. You know, I think that some of them would have liked to kind of set their own rules on this. But, you know, for the large part, they're going along with it. And, you know, I remember Mayor Sylvester Turner in Houston saying kind of, you know, I hope this works and, you know, we'll see and give it our best shot and hopefully keep this virus spread to a minimum.
Well, question then, what about Governor Abbott and his number two, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick? Do they see eye to eye on this stuff?
Yeah, you know, definitely their tone is quite different. And we've been hearing from Dan Patrick, you know, really ever since this all began, kind of, you know, expressing a lot of hesitancy about the economy, you know, talking about whether, you know, certain people, older people would be willing to kind of sacrifice in order to revive the economy. That has continued kind of all the way through. That said, he's not outright criticizing Greg Abbott. He's not invoking his name in these complaints. He was there with the governor when these restrictions were announced and, you know, seemed to be trying to say, you know, Texas is leading on this issue.
What is the honky-tonk crawl for freedom? You've been writing about this particular event. What's that about?
Yes, so this is a pub crawl in Fort Worth organized by Chris Putnam, who is a candidate for Congress who finished second in the Republican primary in March. He is, you know, among this group of kind of private citizens who have been really opposed to the restrictions that Abbott and local officials have been putting in place. You know, getting people to kind of march to a bunch of different bars in Fort Worth this weekend. You know, unclear whether it will happen because it'll be unclear whether there will be any bars for Putnam and his group to actually go to. Depends on kind of what the decisions are made by the local businesses. But it's another kind of case of this kind of conservative wing of the Republican Party, you know, not being happy with Abbott right now.
Matthew Watkins is political editor over at the Texas Tribune. Matthew, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Wells on Bar monitoring the talk of Texas on this Friday. I have to remind myself.
I know. TGIF, David. TGIF.
Indeed. And to you.
Well, we talked about this earlier in the program. It's the big story, the reopening of Texas businesses. And we heard briefly from this commenter earlier in the show. She works in the service industry, Genevieve Coons Herndon. She has some very interesting remarks here that I'd like to read more of. She notes that she's seen public and private posts from business owners and employees voicing concerns, asking for guidance, seeking supplies such as thermometers, sanitizer, gloves, and masks in the scramble to reopen. She says, luckily, her place of employment hasn't reached out about reopening yet. She goes on to say that she's also seen many posts online from businesses who plan on skirting the new guidelines to get away with as much as possible, such as adding tables and chairs to their parking lot, which supposedly would allow them to serve more than that 25% occupancy. And she's also noting that they're receiving some encouragement from the general public and local officials to be creative. She also notes that she's seen businesses being told local law enforcement don't have the capability to police that 25% occupancy and won't even try. So again, raising some serious questions about these rules, who will be enforcing them, the extent to which they're enforced, and the like. Continuing to hear as well from people just on whether or not they're going to venture out this weekend, and seeing a wide range of responses, but most people saying, no, we're going to stay put for now, seems to be the majority sentiment. Danielle Cork writes that, with great privilege, I say that we will continue to stay home and isolate ourselves, especially over the next couple of weeks. And she continues to plan on using curbside delivery services like that for any staples she may need. Christopher Bart says, I think the only people who will appreciate the change are people who are trying to pretend nothing was different all along. The people who were ticked off, they couldn't just go wherever, whenever. That's who is getting the quote-unquote help by reopening today, he writes. And lastly, Phil Mackey writes that the situation highlights how little state leadership cares for our citizens. Reopening comes at a cost, and everyone who has half a brain knows it. So definitely raising some concern out there, David. It's hard not to imagine that it wouldn't be.
I'm seeing a story coming out of New York. This New York Times has got this, and it sounds rather familiar. In upstate New York, a backlash over the shutdown. The story goes on to say that swaths of upstate New York are largely untouched by the pandemic, and some residents are more worried about the economy than about their health. There are obvious echoes here in the Lone Star State as well, where there have been large parts of the state which appear to have been untouched by the coronavirus. But, of course, appearances can be deceiving, and healthcare experts have been very concerned about this. But we are starting to see a flare-up in these tensions across Texas. You can keep up with what's happening across the weekend over at texasstandard.org. We're out of time for the big broadcast, but we're going to be back here on Monday, and we hope you'll join us then. Till then, I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar and the rest of the Texas Standard crew, wishing you a terrific weekend.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family. Would your company or organization like to be a sponsor as well? Contact your local station for opportunities within your community. For statewide sponsorships, visit texaspublicmedianetwork.com.